is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I was there for 26 years, 18 of those years with Coach Ralph Underhill, and he was a phenomenal guy. I never felt like I was working for him. I was working with him. I cherished those 18 years we were together.
Jim Brown served as an assistant, associate, and head coach for the Wright State University men's basketball team for 27 years. He was an assistant coach under head coach John Ross, Wright State's first coach, and continued in that role with head coaches Marcus Jackson and Ralph Underhill, becoming associate head coach in 1993. He was then appointed the head coach for the 1996-97 season. During his time with the Raiders, the program moved from high school gyms to the PE building, to the Nutter Center, and from a Division II independent to a member of the Horizon League and Division I. After leaving Wright State, Brown was the head boys varsity basketball coach at Northmont High School in Clayton, Ohio for 16 years. Jim currently works alongside Chris Collins, calling Wright State men's basketball games on the radio. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Scott Nagy, head men's basketball coach at Wright State University, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Grab your notebook and pen as you listen to this episode with Jim Brown, former head coach at Wright State University and Northmont High School in the state of Ohio. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel, and we are pleased to welcome to the podcast the former head coach, assistant coach, and associate head coach at Wright State University and former head coach at Northmont High School here in the state of Ohio, Jim Brown. Jim, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Well, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We are thrilled to be able to have you on. We are thankful to our mutual friend, Tim Gallagher, for connecting us. And Jim, I want to start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Well, my father was a basketball coach. I have very little recollection of it, but my father was a basketball coach. He played college basketball at Ohio Northern University here in Ohio. And he was a coach at a real small school down in Southeastern Ohio, not too far from Athens, called Corning High School. And he actually, it was a Class B school at the time, a small school. He actually had the player of the year in the state of Ohio and took his team to the state championship in Columbus. And they got beat, I think, in the semifinals by Columbiana. And then he moved to a real small school just outside of Lancaster, Ohio, called Rushville High School. And I don't know really what happened there because we moved to Dayton. He got out of coaching. I think when he went there, he was probably offered more money, thought it was a better opportunity. And he got there and it wasn't what he thought it was going to be, or he kind of soured on coaching. I don't know. Never really found out the exact reason. But anyway, in 1950, we moved from Lancaster to Dayton, Ohio. And I guess my first love with basketball really started about the seventh grade. You know, back in those days, you didn't have AAU basketball. You didn't have basketball camps. If you wanted to go play, you had to go to a blacktop at a park. And there was a school near my house that I went to school at. I could walk to. And my seventh grade coach, he was my seventh grade coach and my eighth grade coach. He's the kind of junior high coaches I wish there were more of, because he really made me fall in love with basketball. It was so much fun. I just really enjoyed him as a coach. Didn't realize it at the time, of course, but the impact he had on my life as a young kid. Because my dad, you know, was out of coaching at that time. He went into private business but it was really interesting. And then I became a University of Dayton basketball fan. My dad showed me how to do a scorecard, and we kept score of the Flyers when I was in junior high, seventh and eighth grade. And that was, I was about as big a UD Flyer basketball fan as you could imagine at that time. I really was. I lived and died with the Dayton Flyers. And so that's where it all got started for me.
A little different today. Not many people are doing their scorecard anymore.
No. I mean, he would take a piece of paper and he would draw. I think he did it for me at first, and then I started doing it. And we kept score of the games on radio, listened to the game on radio, and keep score. And there's a lot of things that are different today when it comes to playing basketball. I mean,
absolutely.
My first experience of playing on a wood floor was when I was in the seventh grade. You got kids 8 years old playing on wood floors now. I mean, it's totally different.
Yeah, nobody talked about playing on the blacktop. It's kind of been a running theme on the podcast that you tell kids today, hey, we used to play a lot of basketball outside, and they look at you like you're crazy. They can't have any no concept that that's what used to happen all the time, especially when you think about guys who are really good players who from a young age have been playing travel basketball, have been playing AAU basketball. Like, those kids are playing in gyms with a coach, with parents on the sideline with a scoreboard, whereas the way you grew up, and certainly I know the way I grew up, was you were just outside and you were playing on your driveway, and then eventually you were playing at the park and you were playing against guys, and it was windy and there was pebbles on the court and you were playing on cement and all these other things that kids today really don't do and don't have to, I guess, deal with those elements the way that you or I probably did growing up.
No, and it's really interesting. I played at this park. As I said, I could walk to it. It was called Grant School, and it was a blacktop park. And you actually only played at one end. You didn't play full court. And the funny part about it, they were all older than me. I mean, I was in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th grade. And every night, I was so fortunate because this became a very popular park to play basketball at. And every night there would be 9, 10, 15 guys that were older than me. I mean, they were out of college. And there was this one guy it's really a funny story. I have not seen this guy in 60 years. He lives in Florida. His son somehow got my telephone number, and he called me from Florida, and he and his son were coming up to Ohio. And I had lunch with him last week, and we had not seen each other in 60 years.
Wow.
And I was telling him the story. I don't know whether I was an eighth grader, ninth grader, freshman, or sophomore, but we were playing down there one night, and he says to me, he says, "Jim, you're never going to be a player unless you learn to chew tobacco." And I said, "What?" He pulls out his Red Man pouch of tobacco and gives me a wad of it. And I put it in my mouth, and I immediately got sick, of course, and spit it out. I tell him that story the other day when we were having lunch, and he was just laughing like crazy. But I told him, I said, you don't realize this, but you had so much influence on me as a young kid, because when I was a seventh and eighth grader, I was probably the best player on our team. And then I went to Big Belmont High School, which it was a big high school at the time. There were like four or five elementary schools that fed into it. And of course, I thought I was just everything because I was the best player on my eighth grade team. And I get there, and I struggled. I mean, I barely made the freshman team and didn't play very much. And his name was Buck Irwin, and he really encouraged me. I mean, he was so supportive. And I was telling him the other day when we were having lunch, I said, you know, if I hadn't met you, I don't know what my career would have been like in basketball, because you were so supportive of what you thought I could be, and it really encouraged me. And it was just a really cool experience to visit with him again after all these years.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. I mean, it speaks to the relationships that you build in pickup basketball, and it also speaks to the fact that those relationships for kids today just don't exist. So I'll give you a little story from me playing playground basketball. So when I used to go, and I probably started going to the park, I grew up in Strongsville, Ohio. And so I started going to the park and playing basketball up there with adults and whatever, all the mix of ages of guys that used to play. Yep. And I kind of got befriended by a guy who at the time, he seemed obviously a lot older than me. I was probably 13 or 14, and he was probably, I don't know, in his late 20s. But this guy kind of befriended me, and he gave me a nickname. He started calling me Jerry West. And so then at this playground, I was always just known as West. And I tell this story to people all the time, that anybody who knew me in that era will see me, and I don't see those guys just like you. You haven't seen some of them for 60 years. I probably run into guys very, very rarely. But they'll say, "Hey, West, how you doing?" And then people that know me and don't know me from that era, they're looking at me like, what are they even talking? They have no idea what I'm talking about. But anyway, this one guy, he and I became friends, and we'd sometimes just, you know, get there early before people were playing, and we'd be shooting around, or we'd just be sitting on the bench and we'd be talking and whatever. And so this guy at one point, now he didn't give me tobacco, but instead he gave me this bucket hat. And this bucket hat became something that, for whatever reason, the connection that I felt like I had with this guy, like, I love this bucket hat. And so I would wear, and it had like patches of, it looked like almost like patches from jeans. And so that's what this whole hat, it was blue and whatever. And it wasn't, I don't think, the most attractive hat, but I wore this thing everywhere, seriously, in high school. Like, I was wearing it all the time. And you just think back to those relationships that you had. And like you said, I had so many people that encouraged me that were, they weren't my coaches, they weren't my parents, they were just guys that had known me since the time I was 13 or 14 years old, that kind of encouraged me and then watched me as a high school player and kept track of what I was doing as a college player. And I just think that those experiences that I had, to me, are always invaluable. And I've said numerous times that I feel like what kids have missed out on today is something that, look, you just had a reunion with somebody that you hadn't seen in 60 years that you felt like had an impact on your life. And I kind of feel sad for this generation of kids that they don't get to have those experiences. Now they get to have different experiences because I didn't get to play 80 games of AAU in a nice air conditioned gym with, in a lot of cases, good coaching and some of the advantages that kids have today. But I always say I wouldn't trade the way I grew up for what we have today.
No, not at all. And it was a totally different time. But I think, you know, I've thought many, many times. I mean, I was a coach for 43 years, 27 in college and 16 in high school. And I've thought many times how fortunate I was to have a seventh and eighth grade coach that really made the game fun for me. I mean, I enjoyed it. I mean, I'm sure he yelled at me from time to time, but he made it fun. And it wasn't necessarily about winning. I mean, it was about, and I can't believe he did this one time because he was a good coach, but he had two tickets to Belmont High School. Now, remember, I was in the seventh or eighth grade. I guess I was in the eighth grade. And he told everybody he had two tickets to the high school game, and he would give them to the player that scored the most points. Now, I can't believe he did this, and I may have the story wrong or not. But anyway, we played the game, and I guess I shot the ball every time I touched it. And he calls timeout, and he says, "Jim, if you want those tickets that bad, I'll just give them to you. We need to make sure we get good shots." I mean, you know, there's so many kids today that are having bad experiences with young coaches because all they want to do is win. They don't, you know, when I was a high school coach, I would tell my seventh and eighth grade coaches, "Look, guys, it's not about winning. I don't care if you win any games. What it's about is developing talent and keeping these kids interested in this sport so that when they become sophomores and juniors in high school, they're still playing basketball and they haven't given it up because they've had a bad experience in the seventh or eighth grade." And I think that it's really difficult to do that as a coach, to put aside the importance of winning. I used to tell, for 35 years, I taught a coaching class at Wright State University. And one of the things I told those students, until your score of your game is either on Channel 7 at night or in the Daily News, it's not important. It's not important. What's important is that your players get better, they have fun doing what they're doing, and they don't give the game up. And, you know, you say that, but that's a difficult thing for a young coach to understand and come to grips with, because, you know, there's so much emphasis put on winning. You know, you have these fourth and fifth graders playing in a select league, and they're pressing full court the entire game. It makes no sense whatsoever why, you know, that sort of stuff is going on today, but it is. And you just wonder from time to time, like, how many kids give up playing basketball because, you know, they've had a bad experience from a coach that coached for the wrong reasons.
I think there is way more than we would like to think about when it comes to kids that have walked away from the game because of bad experiences. And I mean, I know I've experienced it in terms of just talking with the number of people that I've talked to, parents of kids, and then just being around it as coaching my own kids in rec youth basketball and then in travel basketball with their community team and then coaching them at the AAU level. And you see the teams that you play against that you couldn't have given a better description of, teams that have fourth or fifth grade and they're pressing all over the floor, or you have a girls' fourth grade team that's playing a 2-3 zone, and you just look at all these different things and you wonder, like, what is it about these coaches that pushes them to win over the idea that you have to develop the kids? And I think you've said it tremendously well, that the game has to be fun and you want to keep them playing. And one of the things that I've always said to parents is look, what you want to do with your kid is you want to give them the opportunity to experience as many different things as they can, because when they're 10 or 11 and they haven't hit puberty yet, you have no idea what they're going to become as a person, as an athlete. Are they going to be tall? Are they going to be short? Are they going to be fast? Are they going to be slow? Are they going to be strong? What's their body going to look like? And it's just, we drive so many kids out because of that culture of winning. And I think that what you talked about in terms of teaching your class at Wright State, what we really need, and I think that there's USA Basketball, I know, has tried to do it, but it's such a daunting task, is to try to have more coach education and get people to understand, like, look, whether you're a parent volunteer or you're actually coaching at the middle school level or whatever it may be, that it should be about development. But unfortunately, again, our society tends to value winning. And a lot of times parents, especially in the AAU side of it, they'll chase that winning, right? They don't care about the quality of the coach or if the players are being developed. They're just looking at that bottom line. And it's something that I think in the youth basketball space, we're fighting that constantly, Jim. We're just fighting against it all the time.
I went to Northmont High School, they had two freshman teams. And two seventh grade teams and two eighth grade teams. And what they were doing was they were putting their 10 best players, in their view, on the one team and the next 10 best players on the other team. And I went there and I said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to have a draft. Team A is going to pick what they feel is the best center. And then the other team's going to pick the best point guard. And boy, did I meet with some resistance. They said, yo, we'll never win any games. And I said, well, look, this is the thing. If I put the 10 best players on one team, five of them aren't going to play a whole lot. But if I put the 10 best players on two teams, the 10 best players are all going to play a lot. And we'll still win. And they said, oh, no, you'll never win with that. Well, we did. We won a couple of championships doing it that way. But my whole point was, you know, I wanted – guys to have it, because in the seventh and eighth grade, as you just said, you don't know. You know, I always would talk about when I was teaching that class at Wright State and trying to get these young coaches, because their first job was probably going to be coaching a fifth grade team or a sixth grade team or a seventh. That was going to be their first job. And I tried to convince them that you have no idea how a kid's going to develop, whether he's going to, you know, I would tell my kids in high school, you know, if you're going to get better at the game of basketball, you got to have a passion for to practice. And it, you can't go to CVS and you can go to CVS and get a flu shot, but you can't go there and get a basketball passion shot. You either have it or you don't. And so these kids that, you know, they have to develop that passion. And if they don't have it, they're, you know, they're going to go someplace else. But you as a coach, you can help with that. I mean, by making it fun and having an enjoyable time. And I told my seventh and eighth coaches, look, everybody on your team is going to have to start at least two games. I don't care how long you're playing, but he's got to start two games. I want that kid at the end of the year to be able to tell his buddies, I started a couple of games. And you know, I didn't go over and check them. I just, that was what I tried to encourage them to do. And I just, you know, when I first went to Northmont, they hadn't had a winning season in a long time. We had 16 straight winning seasons. So something we were doing was right. And I feel very strongly about youth basketball and the changes that should be made to make it better. I mean, you can probably guess I'm not a real fan of AAU basketball for fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. I'm in favor of recreational basketball where they play neighborhood. But when you're a fourth grader and you're going to 2.5 hours to play in a tournament, I don't think that's a good way. And then the problem today, Mike, is these parents they've bought into this. They think that, you know, doing that's going to guarantee them a college scholarship someplace. It's crazy, but that's the mindset, you know. This actually happened to me. We moved to Beaver Creek. We lived in Dayton, and we moved to Beaver Creek, which is a suburb of Dayton. And when we moved there, my youngest son was tall for his age, and he wanted to play for this select program in Beaver Creek called the Beaver Creek Stars. And he was a third grader, and he found out that as a third grader, he could try out for the fourth grade team. That was the first team they had, was the fourth grade. And he was a third grader, but he could try out. So he tries out, and he makes the team. Well, I'm coaching at Wright State, and they asked me to be the speaker at their banquet at the end of the year. So I did. And I'm driving in the home of the car with my wife, and she turns to me. She says, you know, Anthony's not going to do this next year. I said, what are you talking about? She says, no, he hated it, Jim. I says, oh, come on. She says, well, you know, you weren't home a lot. You were he hated it. He didn't like running suicides. He didn't like getting yelled at. And I didn't say anything. Well, the next season came around, and he didn't want to play. And the coach calls me on the phone and says, hey, Jim, Anthony hasn't been at a practice. And I said, well, you know, Anthony's not going to play. And it didn't hurt his career at all. I mean, he played, you know, my wife's Catholic. He played on a CYO team, and when he went to the high school, he started every single game of his high school career. But it told me right away that, you know, he didn't have a good experience. And I think the fact that Dad was a coach, yeah, kept him interested in the game. But I've thought many times, what would have happened to Anthony if his dad hadn't been a coach, you know, and he had that experience as a third grader? Would have he given up basketball? You know, those are the things that, you know, as a coach, you try to prevent from happening.
Absolutely. And I think to go along with coach education, there's also, as you said, parent education.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly. But as you said, parents have sort of been indoctrinated into the idea that you have to play this in fourth grade, or you have to do this in fifth grade, and that if you don't, that somehow your kid is falling behind. And I remember, it's funny because my son is going to be a senior this year. And I have a daughter who, she stopped playing basketball as a ninth grader. She's going to be a sophomore in college. And I have another daughter who's going to be in eighth grade this year. And so before I had my kids, I remember I would have conversations with parents about the, you know, speaking to what you talked about, where you'd like to see kids playing rec basketball and playing in their neighborhoods. And obviously that's the way you grew up, and that's the way I grew up. And I remember talking to people and saying to them, like, I just don't know how many kids, and this is before I had my own kids, I just don't know how many kids there are that are out there that want to play basketball or any sport for that matter, that they're 8 years old and they want to go practice three times a week for two hours and then go and play whatever X number of games on the weekend. Like, don't get me wrong, there are kids who are 8 years old who want to do that. but yep. they are very rare. There are kids who are like that, but there aren't very many of them. Most kids would rather do a variety of different things yeah. and just kind of focus on being a kid. And I think once my kids got into it, what you find out as a parent is that you kind of are forced into that system because the alternative is nothing. There's nothing out there. And so what I found that I had to do was I had to coach those teams to make sure that I was able to control the environment that my kids were in, and I could make it fun and I could do the things that yeah. you were describing to make sure that, hey, I want every kid on my team to be able to come back the next year and want to play again and not drive them away like the coach drove away your son. And it's just, yeah. it's yeah. such a vicious cycle, and parents just don't understand what the process looks like and yeah, what it needs to look like.
Yeah, they don't have the experience of you or myself that has been through it and knows. You know, I was going to say this when I was teaching that class at Wright State, and I was trying to bring across the point that you have no idea what's going to turn out with when you're coaching a seventh or an eighth grade team. And I always would bring out the fact one of the greatest teams in the history of professional basketball is the Chicago Bulls. And they had three players on their team. Michael Jordan was cut as a freshman. That's well documented. Scottie Pippen went to Central Arkansas as a basketball manager. He didn't even go as a walk-on or a scholarship player. And then Dennis Rodman, look at his background. And those are two of them were top 50 players of all time. And, you know, those all happened after the seventh grade. You know, I mean, Jordan was cut as a freshman and Pippen went to college as a basketball manager. That if you hear that story and you think as you have an idea what a seventh grader is going to be like as a high school senior or a college friend, I mean, it's crazy. So, like I said, it's a very difficult thing for a young coach, 22, 23 years old with his first job, to have that kind of philosophy coaching a seventh or eighth grade team, or even a fourth or a fifth grade team for that matter. It's very difficult. I understand that and I appreciate it. But still, if you can somehow get it across to those young coaches that's the proper approach, as it doesn't matter how many games your fifth grade team wins, are those fifth graders still playing basketball when they're in high school?
Yep. Part of that's a trickle down effect too, right? Because if I'm a junior high coach or a middle school coach, then part of my philosophy should be coming from my high school varsity coach.
Yes.
And
yes.
on the same token, when you talk about AAU, right, that if I'm a four, and there are a lot of AAU programs that do things right. There are unfortunately a lot of AAU programs that do things wrong. Mm-hmm. But if you have a good AAU program, you can have a good experience playing fourth grade or fifth grade AAU if you have a coach who makes it fun and makes it about developing the players, and you don't get in the car and travel 4 hours or out of state or do all these things that these teams do and these coaches do and these parents do with the idea that what I laugh about, Jim, and at some point, man, I think I might have to write a book, but like I said, my son is going to be a senior. And so the last 2 years, he's played on a pretty good AAU team. And so going into his junior year, our team was pretty good. And we've got a number of players who are going to play college basketball probably at some level. And our team was 37-3 and nobody was watching us. There was no colleges watching us at all going into our junior year. And we have, again, guys that are going to play college basketball, but nobody was watching us going into our junior year. And yet you see all these people that are traveling to these showcases and tournaments that are being advertised that, hey, there's coaches here and you're going to be ranked and all these things. And you just wish you could tell people like, hey, relax. If your kid loves the game, as you said, you can't get a shot for basketball passion. Like either you have it or you don't. And it's funny because growing up, like I was a kid myself who, I mean, I loved it from the time I was little and couldn't get enough. And my kids were all different than that. And my son, I when we started the podcast in 2018, and Jason can probably attest to this, I used to say all the time that like my kids are not wired like I was. Like I was just, you couldn't give me enough. And so I used to say to my son, like he likes the game. He likes going to practice. He works hard when he's there. but he doesn't put that extra time in. And now all of a sudden, after he was in ninth grade, all of a sudden that light came on and he completely shifted and started working at it and started working at it and working at it. And a kid who would never pick up a ball on his own, now he's charting everything he does and he's putting in all this time and he's going to end up being a college basketball player at some point. And again, if you could go back and listen to our episodes of the podcast in 2018, 2019, you'd hear me saying, hey, he just doesn't have that same passion for the game that I had. But at some point it turned on, but he hadn't been turned off to the game. He had.
Right. See, that's the point right there. That is the key point, is because for me, it happened after my sophomore year. When I was a sophomore and I played very, very little, I came to the realization that, look, if I want to be good, I'm going to have to put in 4 or 5 hours a day and get better. That's the only way. Basketball is a skill game. I mean, you have to practice, and all sports are skill games, but basketball is unique because it's a 10-foot basket with a big ball, and they get these fourth and fifth graders, 10-year-olds, to start, and it's impossible to dribble a ball very well at that age. And you just never know, you know, as a parent, expose your kids to those things. And if they're going to do it, that passion will come. And it doesn't matter whether it's my fear is it comes too early. Like in your son's case, it didn't come until he was in high school. Well, that's great because, you know, he isn't burned out. He's ready to explode his talents. And I think that's the best scenario of all, when a kid develops that passion, you know, later on, because there's so many things kids want to do today, and it's you know, it is what it is. But it's good to hear that that's what happened to your son.
Yeah, and it's hard too. I mean, to be honest with you, Jim. I mean, when I think about my journey as a parent, especially being wired the way that I was, it's hard to say, okay, I'm going to the gym to do some workouts with some kids, or I'm going to camp and whatever, and hey, I got the keys to this gym. You want to go and shoot? And to have your kids say to you, nah, I don't really want to go.
Exactly.
That is really difficult to not be the guy who forces them. And look, I know the right answer. The right answer is you don't force them. I know that that's the right way to go. But there were many times where it was hard to not take them. And there were some times where I'm like, guess what? You're going, even if you don't want to go. And and I know how to, you know, I mean, again, I kind of know the landscape. And ultimately what it came down to for me is that as I looked around, and, you know, obviously we've all read stories of the parent who forced their kid to do this or that. And then when they get to be adults, there's no relationship between the child and the parent because sports got in the way of it. And so I made a decision that, as difficult as it was for me, I was just going to make sure that ultimately the game didn't get in the way of when my kids are 26 years old. I want to be able to have that relationship with them. But even for me, who knows those pitfalls, there was still many times when it was very hard give a little swift kick or be like, hey, we're going to go to the gym whether you want to go or not. So I can feel for parents who don't have the same experience that, man, it's hard to navigate. As you said, they just don't know any better.
No, they don't. I came home one day from coaching practice, and my son was in the driveway and he was working on shots. And I said, Anthony, let me see if you can shoot a left-handed layup. He was probably about 10 years old. And he said, I can't do that. It's too hard. And all I said was, well, I'll tell you what, Anthony, there's a kid on the other side of town that's learning how to shoot a left-handed layup, and you're going to get to high school and he's going to kick your butt. And I walked in the house. You know, like you, I was a little pissed off. Right. And about 15 minutes later, he comes in. He says, Dad, come outside. And I went out and he shot a left-handed layup. Now, it was cruel. It was crooked. It wasn't. But I didn't yell at him. All I did was make a comment. And he took that and went with it and learned how to shoot a left-handed layup. And I was proud of myself because that's all I said. You know, I didn't yell at him. I didn't get, it was just one little comment, you know, and sometimes you do that as a coach, you know, those little things to motivate somebody. Sometimes being negative is not the answer. So you know, that's part of coaching is how do you motivate everybody? Because some guys are motivated in different ways, and you got to figure out what rings this bell and gets him going.
What was your favorite memory of being a high school basketball player?
Oh, well, you know, I had a great high school basketball coach. I mean, if you play high school basketball and you play for a coach that prepares you for your profession, which I had no intention of being a basketball coach. I wanted to be a biology teacher, but I played for this coach who, he was way ahead of his time, Mike. I mean, when we were in high school, and I played with Donnie May and Bill Hoskett. Donnie May went to the University of Dayton, was a great player there, and Bill Hoskett went to Ohio State and was a great player. They both played in the NBA for a short period of time. They were sophomores when I was a senior. They won the state championship when they were seniors in Ohio. But my coach, we would play multiple defenses. I mean, we would start the game in a man-to-man, and when we scored 6 points and we would start to change, we'd be in a zone on a made basket and a man-to-man on a missed basket. And I learned how to play a 2-3 zone. I learned how to play a 1-3-1 zone. I learned how to play a 1-2-2 zone, all in high school and playing for this guy. And so, you know, I always felt like a high school coach, your job is to win games, of course, but if you have a player on in your program that can play at the next level, you have to challenge him and make sure he can do that. And I was so fortunate to have the high school coach that I had, because he did all of those things and he was way ahead of his time. So I had so many great memories in high school. My only regret was my parents had me too soon, because those guys won the state championship when I was out of school 2 years. And then when I went to the University of Dayton, they went to the Final Four the year after I graduated. So, I mean, I've told my mom and dad, you had me way too soon. I should have waited a couple more years. I had a better experience. But no, it was my high school. The last 2 years, I only played for Coach Ross my junior and senior year. Just my senior year. I played for a different coach as a junior, and then he was replaced by Coach Ross. And he prepared me for the coaching profession, no question about that.
When did you know that you wanted to get into coaching? When did that get on your radar?
This is an unreal story. You know, I went to University of Dayton, and I guess when I was a senior, I wanted to be a biology teacher. And when I was a senior at UD, back then, the theory was that if you wanted to be a coach, you had to minor in physical education. And I was way behind in doing that, because I hadn't taken the number of physical education courses that you have to take to get a minor in it. So my senior year, I took like 20 hours of physical education classes just so I could get a teaching certificate to coach in physical education. So I graduate from the University of Dayton, and I took ROTC in college. So I had an Army commitment. I graduated. I became a second lieutenant, and eventually I got sent to Vietnam. And I was in Vietnam, and Wright State was starting a basketball program for the very first time. They had never had a basketball program at Wright State. And I got this letter from my high school coach, John Ross, telling me that he was picked as the first coach at Wright State. And he wanted me to be, he says, I know you're getting home sometime in February. I want you to be my assistant coach. And I thought, oh my God, what a change in career this is going to be. And so I wrote him back. I was in a bad place in Vietnam. I was right on the Cambodian border. And so, but I made it back. And then I got back on February 10th of 1970. And a week later, I was recruiting players for Wright State University. And the rest is history. Yeah. So then I became a coach. Yeah.
So you really had no plans to go into coaching. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, boom, here you are coaching at the college level. What was it like starting a program from scratch? Because there aren't many people that get an opportunity to do that.
No, it was very, very difficult. Now I was living the dream, Mike. I mean, I really was. I was a college basketball coach, albeit part time, because the first couple years there, I still taught. I was teaching in the Dayton public school system and going out there part time. And Coach Ross, John Ross, was even part time. As you can imagine, you're starting a program from scratch. You don't have a whole lot of money. You didn't have enough money to pay a head basketball coach his salary. So John was actually working. He was supervising student teachers in the morning and then coaching in the afternoon. I was visiting high schools throughout the southern half of Ohio for the admissions office. The first 2 years I was still teaching in the Dayton public school system. I was teaching biology and going out there part-time. And each year they kind of upped the program. You know, when we first started, we had no place to practice on campus. We had no gym on campus. We had to practice at a local high school, but we couldn't do that until 9 o'clock at night because they had, you know, they had their freshman team, their JV team, and their varsity team. And so we would go down there at 9 o'clock at night. We would get a van, fill it up with sandwiches, because when we got back to the college, there was no place for the guys to eat. So we would bus down there take a van, go down there, practice, come back, and the van would smell like bologna and salami and ham sandwiches. But yeah, it was hard. I mean, but like I said, I was living the dream because I was coaching college basketball. Now for John Ross, who had won a state championship and this and that, it was very, very difficult. I mean, he had been very, very successful as a high school coach. And when you go there and you're starting from scratch and you're playing schools like Otterbein and Wilmington and Muskegon, and you're not doing well. I think the first year we won 8 games, and then the second year we might have won 9 games. But then we turned it around. I mean, the third season, we won 17 games and started to win. But it was really hard because we didn't have any place on campus. They finally built in 73, which would have been our third or fourth year of basketball. They built a place on campus for us to play, and it seated about 2,500. But it was hard. I mean, it was a great experience for me. But here's the other thing. I was coaching with my high school coach, and so it took me a while to come to grips with, look, you know, he, this is a guy I played for. Now I'm coaching with him. And I can remember we had a meeting one day where there was something that happened, and John had to admonish something that had happened. I don't know what it was. So we walk out of the meeting, and I turned to him. I said, "That was great what you said, Coach." And he said, "Well, I wish you would have spoken up." And it was a kind of a coming to Jesus meeting for me, because I realized, look, you know, I'm not playing for him anymore. I'm coaching with him, and I have some responsibilities here, and I need to speak up when I, you know, the appropriate time. So those first 3 or 4 years were very difficult in terms of building the program. But I think in hindsight, looking back on it, we did it the right way. We really did it the right way. I mean, we eventually got some scholarship money. And you know, when I first went to Wright State, it's a state school, and we only had so much money. We didn't have such a thing as a full scholarship. We might have had $30,000, and we had to split that among 12 or 13 guys. So we didn't have a full scholarship. And so I was recruiting in Youngstown and Cleveland and not having any luck whatsoever, because you had to recruit in-state, because Rice State had this out-of-state tuition thing, which doubled the tuition. So if you recruited a kid in Ohio, it was maybe $2,000. If you recruited a player outside of Ohio, it was like $4,000. So when you had a certain amount of money, you just didn't go out of the state. And it wasn't until, I guess, the fifth or sixth year that they finally told us, look, you have scholarships. Don't worry about whether it's in-state out. And that really turned things around for us, because then we were able to go to, you know, Louisville's a lot closer than Youngstown from Dayton, Ohio. So right. I started recruiting, you know, closer to home and had some success. But, you know, those first 5 years, John coached there for 5 years and then he retired. And those were hard years on him. I know they were. Not so much for me, because like I said, I was a young coach and I was living the dream. I mean, I really was. It was, for me, it was big time. And for John, probably not quite the same.
What did you love about coaching right away? Because obviously it wasn't something that had been on your radar. So you get in there and you guys are building this program from scratch. You're a young guy. And again, you get to do something that maybe you didn't know that you were going to love, but it sounds like you knew you loved it right away. What was it about coaching that you took to right away?
I think it was the recruiting, you know, getting to know players. I don't think I was the greatest recruiter. I mean, at first, I'll be honest, it was very difficult at first because, you know, we were in Dayton, Ohio. We were the new kid on the block, and the papers didn't even know we existed. I mean, we got no publicity whatsoever. I mean, like I said, I was about as big a University of Dayton fan as you can imagine. And when I started coaching at Wright State, I hated UD. I mean, I hated them. I wanted them to lose every game because we got no credibility whatsoever in the Dayton community with the news media. And there were some guys that were on our side, but most of them weren't. And it was very difficult. And I think the recruiting part was so much fun. It was frustrating because, you know, you just were not well known. You didn't have the reputation. And I mean, I was taking a kid around from Dunbar High School one day. That's a local school here in Dayton. And I was taking him around and he said, "Gosh, Coach Brown, I didn't know it was anything like this. My mom told me there was only one building out here." And I mean, those are the kind of things that you dealt with back then. But I was young. I was enthusiastic. I loved the game of basketball. I mean, I just loved the game of basketball. But the recruiting part of getting to know kids and it's sort of recruiting sometimes can be like winning a game because you spend so much time talking to a kid, developing a relationship, and then he says he's coming. It's really I don't know. It's a buzz or whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's a challenge to. Because back in those days, I mean, we didn't have full scholarships. We weren't the biggest school in town. I mean, we didn't get the kind of publicity. And so it was really difficult to get a really good player. And there was a school here in town called Alter High School. And they've been extremely successful down through the years in basketball. I mean, a bunch of John Paxson went there. Jim Paxson went there. They both played in the NBA. I mean, they've had multiple players go to Alter High School that went on to the University of Dayton. And I don't know exactly what year it was. It was in the late 70s. We recruited a player from Alter by the name of Bob Schaefer. He was offered by Dayton. He was offered by Miami. And for whatever reason, he came to Wright State. And I felt like it turned us around in terms of our acceptability in the Dayton area because we got this kid from Alder High School. He was their best player, and he chose us over some of these other schools. And he chose us over because he felt like he was going to be able to play. And he became our all-time leading scorer for quite a while. And it's always fun as a coach to win a big, big game. And I always – you know, I'd listen to these coaches as a young coach, and I'd go to clinics, and they would talk about the thing they enjoyed the most was practice. And I thought, are you kidding me? You enjoy practice more than a game? And yeah, I mean, you've probably heard that yourself. You've heard coaches say, I enjoy the practice part of it more than the game. And when I was a young coach, I didn't understand that. Now, I don't know when it was that I realized that is what it is, you know, being able to teach these kids and breaking down how you make a crossover dribble or how you shoot a left-handed spin layup or whatever. I mean, practice became, I could understand, and I don't know when that went off, when that light bulb went off in my coaching career, when I realized that the practice was a lot more fun than a game. That I don't know. I mean, I don't know when that was that happened, but it happened to me. I mean, I realized that, you know, practice can be a lot more fun, a lot more challenging because, you know, a lot of coaches, a lot of people that aspire to be coaches, they see what the coach does on the sideline. You know, I would go out to, you know, they have these career days where they'll invite, you'll go to a junior high or a elementary school, and they'll bring in these people from different careers, accountants and secretaries, and then you'll talk about your profession. And so I would go to those, and I'd walk into the classroom, and I'd say, okay, how many of you people want to be a teacher? And, you know, there might be, let me phrase that. I would walk in, how many of you in here want to be a coach? And, oh, gosh, they'd all raise their hand. And I'd say, well, then how many of you want to be a teacher? Well, there would only be two or three hands go up. And it really opened the door for me because I would tell, well, you know, coaching is teaching. It's just like being an English teacher or a math teacher. You're teaching the game of basketball. And if you don't know how to do that, then you're going to have trouble. And when I was teaching that class at Wright State, I would always bring this up because I was, how many of you have had a math teacher that you knew was brilliant? He's a brilliant mind, but you didn't understand anything he was saying. And, oh, boy, would you see the eyes light up, you know? I mean, yeah, they all identified with that. Well, it's just, I would tell them it's the same way in coaching basketball. I mean, anybody can stand on the sidelines and rant and rave and put people in and out of a game, but how many people know how to teach a pick and roll? How many know how to, neutralize a ball screen? That's what coaching is. It's teaching the game of basketball. You've got to be able to do that if you're going to be successful. And so, you know, I don't know if I answered your question or not, but I mean, there's so many aspects of coaching that are so rewarding. I mean, it's an unbelievably tough profession because of all the outside things that go in.
Hey, Hoopheads Nation, whether you're a beginner basketball player looking for a place to start or a seasoned vet looking to level up your skills, I want to tell you about your new go-to secret weapon. It's called Train. Train is a basketball training and education platform that gives you on-demand access to premium basketball courses created by expert coaches and trainers from around the world. Want to get better at blowing by your defender? Learn setup drills with NBA and international pro trainer Marius Williams, or how to use the punch drag with NBA trainer Kerry Darting. Looking to level up your catch-and-shoot skills? Practice space shooting workouts with former lead female trainer for Kobe Bryant's Mamba League, San Dixon. Or if you're just starting out, learn the basics of shooting and finishing at the basket from international champion, three-time Romanian Player of the Year, and Train co-founder, Vlad Moldovaniu. Train has 32 and counting actionable, expert-led, on-demand basketball training courses that teach you exactly how to improve your ball handling, shooting, attacking, and more. For a limited time, Hoopheads listeners get 35% off monthly, annual, and lifetime plans. Just go to gotrainbasketball.com/hoopheads to learn more and sign up for a free 7-day trial.
It's impossible today. I am so glad I'm not coaching today with this transfer portal and the NIL. Yeah. I don't know how these guys do it. I really don't. I couldn't handle it. I mean, I could not handle that.
Trying to navigate, I think anybody that we've talked to on the podcast, trying to figure out how to navigate that from a standpoint of how does it affect your program, but then also how do you manage that to help your players, not obviously the transfer portal, but when it comes to NIL, how do you try to make that work in the best possible way for your players, which then obviously benefits your program? And then the transfer portal, I mean, we could circle back to the beginning of our conversation tonight about youth basketball, and think about it's just permeated every level of the game where players in fifth, sixth, seventh grade, you're jumping from one AAU team to another. And then you see so many kids that are jumping from one high school to another because they're chasing this or that or whatever. And then you look at the number of kids that are in the portal. And I always think about, Jim, from my perspective, because since I played at Kent, I always think about it being a situation where I try to always view these things through the eyes of like a mid-major program and how do they handle this kind of stuff, just because that's what my firsthand experience was. Yep. And so from a transfer portal, I always think that, okay, so, you know, it used to be if you're going to be good at a mid-major, what do you have to do? You have to find a kid who's under the radar, who maybe hasn't quite developed yet, and then over the course of the 4 years that they're there with you, you develop them. So their time, by the time they're a junior or senior, they're really, really good. Well, now if you do that at a mid-major and a kid has a good freshman year, a good sophomore year, there's a real good chance that that kid's probably going to leave and go to a bigger school, because those bigger schools look and say, well, this kid's already proved himself as a college basketball player. Yeah. Why do I want to take a high school kid? And so you have that part of it. But then on the other hand, you also have guys that maybe go to a Big Ten school and don't get to play as much as they thought. And now those guys are transferring down to, down a level. So there's so many different aspects of it. And I think the biggest frustration that I hear from most college coaches, and I don't know if your conversations have been the same, but the biggest complaint I think that most of them have is it's really hard to develop a continuity and to understand from one season to the next, like who's going to be on your roster. It's like the season ends and you're like, who's going to be back next year. And you're trying to figure all that out and who's going to be in the portal. And man, it's just to try to have a team that just turns over. It's one thing if you're John Calipari at Kentucky and you're turning your team over every year with one and done guys who are going on to play in the NBA. It's another thing when you're a Wright State or you're a Kent State and you're turning your roster over that much. It's got to be tough on those guys.
Yeah, and then you add the NIL, which I call that now it's legal. I don't even say it's the NIL. Now it's legal. Like I said, I'm so glad I'm not involved in that. I mean, I don't know how they do it. At first, I thought it was killing the mid-major schools, but now you talk to some of these coaches at Big Ten schools, it's happening to them. I mean, then there's no loyalty. When you spend all the time recruiting a young man and then you get him to come and then he's going to leave the first time something, you know, first time, like I've heard Coach Izzo talk about this, first time he gets that. In fact, yelled at, he's got a reason to leave. He talked about Adrian Payne, the guy that plays for Golden State, that played at Michigan State. I can't think of his name now. But anyway, he was at Michigan State, and Izzo talked about, gosh, if that transfer portal was in existence today, he wouldn't have lasted a half a year with me. Because, you know, I was yelling at him, and he would have left. Yeah. And that's one of the things about athletics that's so great is you're challenged, and you have to overcome these challenges and all the things that enter into being a good athlete, no matter what it is, being on a team, those values carry over into your everyday job. And so many of those things are disappearing because of the transfer portal. And we're just going through a really bad time in college athletics right now. It'll work its way out, I hope. But right now, it's not good. It's just not good.
Yeah. I think it's going to eventually settle. I mean, personally, I like the theoretical intent of both the transfer portal and NIL. Again, theoretically, I think trying to execute it is a whole nother thing. But just when you look back on the history of college basketball and you think about the fact that, you know, a coach can recruit a player to a school and then that coach can leave that job. And so and then you look at, okay, so shouldn't players be able to have the same right? I think that they probably should. And yet what that's done is created this just wild, wild west. So I think the intent of the rule is a good one. I think the way it's played out isn't necessarily the best for the players or for college basketball itself. And then NIL, I think the same way. I think the fact that, you know, again, it doesn't necessarily affect players quite as much at Wright State or Kent State because you're not getting these big, giant, huge, lucrative NIL deals. But if you're a player at Ohio State and you have an opportunity to make a significant amount of money, I have no problem with players being able to do that. But it is a matter of now as a coaching staff, it's a whole nother thing that you have to figure out how to navigate it. And then I guess I always look at it, if I was a coach and you're like, okay, this kid has whatever, $10,000 in NIL deal, and this kid has only seven, but the $7,000 kid is starting and the $10,000 kid isn't. And you just think about how much, I'm sure, in your experience as a coach, that you have to navigate the personalities of your team and you're trying to build cohesion. And that's hard enough when you don't start throwing money into it and have all that stuff. I can't imagine what that's like.
I think a perfect example, and I have no inside knowledge, I'm just speaking as an observer of college basketball, but you look at North Carolina University last year, they made it to the Final Four the previous year, had everybody back and didn't even make the tournament. And like I said, I have no inside knowledge, but this is just pure speculation on my part. There had to be some serious chemistry issues on that team because of the NIL and the locker room. It wasn't the same. And like I said, I could be totally wrong, but from an outside observer, I don't know how you navigate that. I don't know how you determine what this kid gets and that kid, because, you know, they all talk. They all are going to know what the player's getting. And it's something that, if they would have put restrictions on this when it became legal, I would have liked to have seen them done something like this. And this is probably way too complicated, but you know, you can take the NIL, but it goes into a trust fund and you have to graduate from that university to receive it. And if you leave early or you don't graduate, you don't get it. But that would have never happened. But that to me would have solved a couple of problems. It would have encouraged kids to graduate. It would have encouraged kids to stay at the same school. And you still satisfied the business of kids getting, you know, money for their likenesses and their names and so on and so on. But, you know, that probably would have never lasted. And some lawyer would have got involved and shut them
down. Yeah, we probably could have used a phase in instead of just going right to the wild, wild west. I think that probably would have been a good idea. But to your point, it's once the cat's out of the bag, it's completely out of the bag.
It's over.
Yeah. I think it's going to eventually settle. There's going to be some equilibrium where I think you're going to find out that companies are going to start to realize where they should put their money and where they shouldn't put their money, and things will kind of start to settle down, and colleges will get a better handle. I mean, I think we're close to the point now where as a Division I program, you almost have to have like a full-time NIL person in your athletic department just to deal with it and try to figure it out. And I'm sure the bigger programs probably you're going to have a person actually that's on their basketball staff or their football staff that's all they're doing is dealing with NIL for basketball or football. I'm sure that we're headed there if we're not there already.
I just read this yesterday. There were over 1,200 kids in basketball that put their name in the transfer portal, and there's like 600 or 700 that haven't found a school yet. And so, you know, I don't know how you do this. I don't know how you – do you call your coach and say, I want to come back? Well, he's already signed somebody else. I mean, there's so many issues with this transfer portal. It's like the kids that put their name in the draft and then don't get drafted and you never hear about them. You just never hear about those kids. And then they've made that a little better. They allow these kids to go to NBA camps now and take their name out. So it's a little easier than it was. But this transfer portal thing's got to be – addressed, because there's an awful lot of kids that are putting their name in the portal. Now, there's a lot of kids that put their name in there that aren't playing where they're at right now. They just feel like they go someplace else and get a better opportunity. And they find out that there aren't any opportunities and they're kind of, their careers are over. So, you know, it's just like, I agree with you. I think it'll work its way out, but we're nowhere near that right now.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's not – I think sometimes players think that it's a magic wand, and a lot of them are getting bad advice from the people around them that, hey, man, you should be playing here, or you should be getting more time. I mean, I think about just my own experiences when I went to Kent, and as a freshman, I maybe played 5 minutes a game, and I think I had a pretty realistic understanding of coming in kind of where – I fit, and I realized like I got to work if I want to get on the floor. And by the time I was a sophomore, I got on the floor and I was out there all the time and then got to play. But you could certainly see, had I grown up in a different era, that after my freshman year, I might have said, ah, man, you know, this isn't working out. Let me try and go somewhere else. And I was already, I mean, as a recruit, I was at best a borderline Division I recruit and ended up having a really good career, but I stuck it out. And I think that perseverance piece. I mean, if I could teach any kid a lesson from my playing career, it would be, hey, you got to figure out a way to persevere through some tough times and figure out what you need to do to get yourself on the floor. And look, just because you go and you transfer to a different program, you're still the same player that you were at the previous program. And so you got to, you know, you got to figure something out. And again, that's not to say some kids, again, you do make a choice to go to a school and for whatever reason, it doesn't work out. And I certainly think that that's where the portal is a positive, but in so many cases, you just have kids that jump in there and they don't get the opportunity that they're looking for. And now, as you said, boom, all of a sudden, you know, you're in no man's land. You don't have a career anymore. And that's what you hate to see. Cause again, you want, right? I mean, we all love the game and you want to see people have a good experience with it. Players, coaches, everybody. I mean, cause we all love the game of basketball, and it feels like in a lot of ways, sometimes kids are losing that opportunity as a result of this instead of gaining an opportunity.
Yep. Sure are.
All right. Tell me about your 1 year as the head coach. What was that like?
Well, it was terrible. I have to back up. I was there for 26 years, 18 of those years with Coach Ralph Underhill. And, he was a phenomenal guy. I never felt like I was working for him. I was working with him. He was just a great guy to coach with. And I cherished those 18 years we were together. And I don't know if you know exactly what happened, but he was accused of shoplifting, which went to trial, and it was all the charges were thrown out. And he actually sued and won some money, but it cost him his job. And so we had recruited a player by Vitaly Potapenko, which is a whole nother story how we did that. He was from Kiev in the Soviet Union, and we recruited him to Wright State. And a great trivia question is who was the player drafted right before Kobe Bryant in the 1993 or 4 draft? Well, it was Vitaly Potapenko. He was the 12th player picked. He was a lottery pick. He went to Cleveland. And so we had him back. I mean, he was coming back for his senior year. So we scheduled Kentucky. We scheduled Louisville. We scheduled Miami with Zerbiak. I mean, Wally Zerbiak. I mean, our schedule was, without question, the toughest schedule Wright State's ever played. And then Ralph gets fired, and I become the head coach, and Vitaly goes to the NBA because he didn't like how that all happened. And I end up playing that schedule with 3 freshmen starting, a junior and a senior, and got absolutely no support from the administrator. I didn't have a very good relationship, I should say, with the athletic director at the time. And so, you know, if you're at a school for 26 years and the head coach leaves, you would think that the assistant coach that's been there that long would be somebody you would strongly consider. But my relationship with that athletic director wasn't the best, and so I knew I wasn't going to get the job. So it was a frustrating year. It really was. I mean, we won 7 games, but we had like 12 games where we were in till the like last 8 or 9 minutes and just couldn't finish the deal because we played such a young team and such a tough schedule. So, you know, I look back on it, it kind of soured me on coaching, to be honest about it. And when that all happened, my contract, they had to pay me another year. So that's the year that I was talked in. Well, the school came after me, that Northmont High School came after me to be their coach. And I hesitated like crazy to do it and finally did it. And it was good for me because I never taught there. I just coached basketball. But I always felt like in my mind that, you know, I could be a successful head coach. And so when I went there and I was the head coach, it reaffirmed my thinking because I was very successful there. But it was, you know, coaching at Wright State, we had some success recruiting foreign players, and we had taken our team to Europe back in the early 90s. We were over there 21 days. We were in Holland 7 days, Germany 7 days, ended up in Paris, France. And I met a man over there by the name of Vladimir Hager, and I developed a relationship with him. And he was you know, back then, this was in the late 1900s, 1990, 94, 95, right in there. There was nobody in the United States recruiting foreign players. Nobody. And the only schools we competed against were Valparaiso and George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Nobody else was recruiting foreign players. In fact, the other night when I was watching the Basketball Hall of Fame, Dirk Nowitzki was picked in the Hall of Fame, and I recruited Dirk Nowitzki. I mean, I called him on the phone, talked with him. This is a great story. I called him on the phone. He was 17 years old. Vladimir Hager had told me about him. He had seen him play in a European tournament, and he sent me a fax. And he said he gave me his phone number and his address and everything. So I call him. And he was very, very nice. He spoke English. And he says, "Well, Coach Brown, I love Germany. I don't want to leave Germany. I'm going to stay here." And so I waited about 3 months. I called him again. Same story. Very nice. Very pleasant to talk to. And so you fast forward about 4 years, and I'm sitting in my living room watching the NBA draft. And I don't know what number he was, but it says the Milwaukee Bucks draft Dirk Nowitzki. And holy cow, that's the guy I was talking to. And yeah. I called John Hill right away. I said, "You're not going to believe this. You remember that player that I was recruiting from Germany? He just got drafted in the first round of the NBA. So, I mean, and then when we recruited Vitaly, we had him in our school for a year. I got a call from a Russian coach. I couldn't tell you who he was, but he was telling me about this player that wanted to come to the United States and play for 1 year. And he says, "I know you have Vitaly Potapenko, and he's from Russia, but this player, his name is Zagrunas Agauskas. Yep. And he's 7'2", and he wants to come and play. He wants to come to Wright State." And you know, of course, I knew nothing about him. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know this guy that I was talking to on the phone. I mean, you know how that is. You don't know whether he's telling you the truth or not.
Right.
I did some checking and found out that it was legit. And so we're in the process of finalizing his admission to Wright State, and he breaks his foot. It was like in August, and he broke his foot. And I don't know if you remember, but when he was drafted by Cleveland, he and Vitaly were drafted right after each other. I think Vitaly was 12 and Zagrunas was 14. When he came to the United States, he had serious microfracture surgery on his foot. And they didn't know whether he was going to be able to play. Well, he played in the NBA for what? 18, 19 years.
Yeah, long time. Well, those two guys became friends, because it's funny, because when that was in the era, so we're talking like what, the mid to late 90s. So at that point, I was 26, 27, 28 years old. And I remember going out to bars in the Cleveland area, and those two guys were always together. Like, you'd walk, and obviously they stand out as Bogauskas is 7'2", and Topico was 6'10". And so you see these two big guys standing by the bar when they were playing for the Cavs together. So yeah, I clearly remember the two of them being friends and being on the Cavs together at that point.
Well, Vitaly, you know, the guy gave me his telephone number and everything. So the first time I called Vitaly, his mom answers the phone and I hang up. She speaks Russian, and I hung up. And I thought, well, okay, I waited a few days. And of course, there's a big time difference between Dayton, Ohio and Kiev and the Soviet Union. So I waited I called again. She answers the phone again. I hang up again. Well, you have to – this is where I'm real proud of myself, because a lot of coaches probably would have said, "The heck with this. I'm not going to – because I didn't know how good he was. I mean, I was going by this guy's word. He had seen him play in a tournament. So I called a third time and hung up again. And so I'm thinking, there's got to be somebody on our campus that can speak Russian. So nobody – I couldn't find anybody on Wright State's campus that spoke Russian. So I called down to the University of Dayton. And this woman came out to my office, sat down. We called the number. The mother answers the phone. This lady could speak Russian. And Vitaly was there. And that's how it all got started. But the interesting thing is, he was probably the best player in all of Kiev at that time. And the coach of his team had his passport. So Vitaly couldn't. He didn't have a passport. The coach had the passport. We're talking Russia, you know. So I was so fortunate. We were so fortunate at Wright State because I was speaking downtown at one of these Rotary Club things. And I was talking about Wright State basketball, and I talked about, you know, the players that we had had and a couple from Europe. And that was anyway, at the end of my speech, I said, are there any questions? And this one guy says, well, yeah, he says, are you recruiting any foreign players right now? And I said, well, yeah, kind of. We have this one player from Kiev, but we're having a lot of trouble. He doesn't have his passport. His coach got it. And I don't know. And it doesn't sound like we're going to be able to work things out. So that was it. Well, after this speech, this guy comes up to me. He's a lawyer. And he says, hey, Jim, he said, tell me more about this kid in Russia. And I told him, he said, well, I might be able to help you out. And to make a long story short, a lawyer in his office was Russian. He traveled back and forth to Russia about twice a month, and he was willing to help us out. He had never been to a Wright State basketball game, never gave money to the university, so he wasn't considered a booster. And he went over there, got a new passport for Vitaly, translated all of his documents and everything, and it's an amazing story. I mean, it's just an amazing story. And, you know, he's an assistant coach with the Memphis Grizzlies now. He's done really well for himself. But it's just it's amazing how things can happen sometimes. And something like that can really happen. Now, today, you have these colleges that are recruiting overseas like crazy. I mean, just about every college team's got somebody from Europe on their team.
Absolutely. All you got to do is look at the NBA draft or look at any college team's roster, and the amount of foreign players and the way the international game has exploded. I mean, it really is. It's kind of incredible when you think back to, if you
it's really incredible, because that was 19. We recruited Vitaly in like 94. And as I said, the only competition we had was Valparaiso over in Indiana and George Washington. Nobody else was recruiting foreign players. And I owe all of that success to Vladimir Hager. He was from Holland, and he went to a lot of, you know, he coached a team over there, and he would go to these tournaments. And back then we didn't have cell phones, so everything was done by fax. And all he wanted me to do was send him NBA Street and Smith books, you know. So I sent those things, and he would send me faxes with names and numbers. And we ended up, you know, recruiting three or four kids. I got a couple high school kids to come over here, helped him out that way. He wanted to get a couple kids over here, and we got them over here. So, it was well worth it. And of course, you know, it was a lot of, well, it wasn't easy. I mean, it was very difficult. It was very difficult recruiting foreign players. I mean, no question about it. You had to have a lot of patience, but it's a lot easier now. I mean, the NCAA, you know, we had one kid, and this is when this was first starting, and the NCAA was finding out that these kids were coming over here, and they were playing professional basketball over there. You know, they were getting paid in Europe.
Right.
I can remember this one kid. You know, he had to fill out this form. The NCAA was getting involved in it. And he said, well, I have to fill this out. And I said, yeah. And I'm telling you right now, Steno, if you answer that one question, yes, you're probably going to be ineligible. But I'm not telling you how to answer it. So anyway, he answered it no, and he was okay. But I mean, it was not easy to recruit foreign players, but we had a lot of success. We really did. We got about five of them, I think, during my time there.
That's funny. I mean, it hearing you tell those stories, I don't know. Jason's going to have to fact check me on this. I don't know if I ever told this story on the podcast, but my dad was a professor at Cleveland State. And so one day he came home from work, and this is probably when I was, I think I must've been in high school. And he comes home and he says to me, Mike, you got to come down to the gym. You're not going to believe this. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I have no idea. And he wouldn't tell me. And so I go down to Cleveland State with my dad, and in the old Woodling gym where they used to play, there was like an overhang that, so the basket, and then there was an overhang. So if you walked in from the lobby, you would walk out under this overhang. So I'm standing on the overhang, and my dad's like, just wait. He goes, you know, you'll see in a second. And I'm standing there, and all of a sudden this guy walks out from underneath this, you know, this overhang, and the guy's like 7'7" and weighs about 170 pounds. And it was Manute. And yeah. So Manute Bol comes out, and he's got like, I mean, we all know how skinny Manute was by the time he got on the public's radar.
Yep.
Well, when he was there at Cleveland State, I mean, he had literally just come over. And he is literally like his leg was like a stick, and then his knee was this big ball, and then the rest of his leg was another stick. And so his knees just looked like this big ball that were attached to two bones. And the only thing that he could say at that point was ball. So he would just kind of walk around, and he would just say ball, ball. And I just remember me and my dad having this conversation like, all right, it's going to be really interesting to see how Coach Mackey gets Manute Bol into school when the only word that he can say in English is ball. How's this going to work? And of course he was there for a couple months, and then they never did get him in and eligible. And he ended up going to, I think what, Bridgeport up in Connecticut, yeah, division two school. And then obviously went on to the NBA, but man, I mean, just
I now understand the origin story of Mike's obsession with Bol Bol.
Yeah. Yes. See, that's why I'm such a fan of Bol Bol. So yeah, but Manute, I mean, my dad, again, I give him all the credit because he didn't tell me what I was about to see. Yeah. And I'll never forget the first time I laid eyes. I mean, that picture is cemented in my brain of just how skinny and tall Manute was. It was crazy back there. So yeah, recruiting foreign players is quite an adventure.
Do you remember when Mouse McFadden played at Cleveland State?
Absolutely. So I used to play with Mouse. I used to play with Mouse all the time.
This is a funny story. I was recruiting in New York City at the time, and there was this guy helping me out. He was helping me with, because I'd never been to New York City in my life, and he was helping me find players. And I had some success. I recruited a couple players out of New York City that year. But he told me, he says, there's this one player. He says, I don't know where he's at, Jim. He says, I can't find him. Nobody knows where he's at. His name's Kenny McFadden, and he's in New York City at some school, but nobody knows where he's at. And he'd be a great player for you guys, and I could help you out. And, you know, 2 years later, he's playing at Cleveland State. Mackey found out where he was, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Mouse was, man, he could play, man. He was he was quite a player back in the day. I spent a lot of time down at Woodling Gym when I was young as a high school player, just trying to get into games. And then eventually, as I got to be a high school player, I was able to kind of sneak my way into some open gyms. I always say this, I still see, I don't know if you, do you remember Clinton Smith?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Clinton is still around up here in the Cleveland area, and so I still run into him. Just he's doing some stuff with coaching youth basketball, and so I'll run into Clinton every once in a while. I always say that I really love Clinton because he was one of those guys that back in the day, skinny little high school kid trying to get into a game on a college campus with dudes wasn't always the easiest. And Clinton kind of looked out for me and would say, hey, I'll take Mike on my team. And so I kind of always have a soft spot for Clinton. And, but that era of Cleveland State basketball was a lot of fun. I mean, it was a lot of fun.
Cleveland State was the first Division I school that Wright State would play. I mean, Ray Derringer and John Ross had a relationship, and we went up there and played in Public Hall, old Public Hall.
Public Hall. Yeah. So Public Hall, we used to go to games, and literally there would be times when you'd go to Public Hall and there'd be like 30 people in Public Hall. And my sister and I, they had all that because it was shaped like a horseshoe. They had all that space behind the court, you know, so it was just basically open space, and my sister and I used to take like the little plastic balls that the cheerleaders would throw out, and her and I, like the game would be going on, and her and I would be over in that open area just throwing the ball to each other and running around as little kids. And I remember sitting in the stands and watching Frank Edwards and Lee Reed and Mike Sweeney and Darren Tillis and all those guys from that era playing playing at Public Hall. Great memories of Cleveland State basketball for me as a kid.
Ray Derringer was so nice to play. I mean, we played them several times back when we first got started. We were Division II, and I know we went up there and played in Public Hall two or three times. We've played Cleveland State a ton of times. Of course, they're in the league with us now. But, I mean, back in the day, I mean, Ray Derringer agreed to play us when he had no business playing us. I mean, he had no reason because I don't know that I don't know. I'd have to go back and look whether we ever beat him up there. But I mean, I know he was nice enough to play us back when, you know, playing a Division I school back when you're just starting your program. I mean, my goodness, that was, you got coaches to do that. That was something else. And he,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. No question about that. I mean, it's kind of crazy. All right. We have about 3 minutes if I'm going to make my goal. So okay. Just tell me a little bit about the radio gig real quick, how you got the radio gig and what you love about it. And then after you do that, we'll jump in and wrap things up.
Okay. Well, when I retired, I was at the high school there for 16 years. And when I retired, this friend of mine who had done games at Wright State, he was doing some high school games on the weekend. And he said, "Hey, Jim, would you be my partner?" And I said, "Well, sure, I'll do that." And so I did it. Well, then Wright State found out I was doing that, and they approached me. They were, at that time, they couldn't get anybody to go on the road with them consistently. So they were, you know, they were having different people do games, and they approached me and said, "Well, would you do this full time?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll do it full time." And so I did, and Chris Collins is the play-by-play guy, and he is phenomenal. I mean, he is so good. And I didn't even know him. I had I'd heard him on radio. He was did a morning show in the morning. I heard him on radio, but I didn't know him at all. And we hit it off right away, and we have a great relationship. And I enjoy it. I really enjoy it. And the great part about it, and you'll appreciate this, win or lose, it doesn't bother me. I can go have a beer and I'm fine. my blood is green. I mean, I root like crazy for the Raiders, but doing the games on radio has been so much fun. And the thing I enjoy the most, I think about it, is after, you know, when the Raiders win, we have a post game show. We interview Coach Nagy, but then we also get to interview a player. And then the coach has a show once a week, and we interview players on that. And getting to know the players, it's kept me involved in the game. It's a commitment. I mean, I'm 79 years old, and I, you know, my wife and I we're celebrating 56 years of marriage this weekend, and she's not real crazy about me, you know, being gone for 3 or 4 days. You know, she says, "You've done that, Jim, you know, come on." But she supports it and allows me to do it. And it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it.
That's awesome. I mean, as you said, to be able to keep you involved in the game, and I can completely relate to your ability to walk away from a win or a loss. I always equate it to, as a coach, when I was coaching my third, fourth, fifth grade team, again, this goes back to our beginning of our conversation, right? Like, I know it's about development, but yet when my team would lose, I would still think about it. What can we do differently to try to win these games and this and that? And then when I'm a parent, I'm almost completely opposite. Like, the game's over, and 30 seconds after it's over, I'm good with whatever the result was, as long as my kids played hard and were coachable and all the things that you want them to be. So it is a completely different perspective when you're coaching a team versus when you are and I don't want to say completely a casual observer, but when you are not in the inner circle of that team, it is a completely different feeling without question. It is completely different.
The toughest part about coaching is if you're at a college or even a high school, and you get beat, you feel like you let all the fans down. That was the part that was the toughest for me. I mean, I can handle the loss, but I noticed this big time when we went from playing in the PE building where there were 2,200 people there to the Nutter Center where there were 10,000 people there. It was, oh gosh, when you lost all these, you let them down, and you felt this tremendous, it was just a terrible feeling. And not so much that you got beat, but all these fans that support you are crushed. And that's the tough part. But, you know, I don't deal with that as a radio guy.
Exactly. Jim.
Really enjoyed this. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. Yeah, this has been a blast. And we can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to jump on and join us. Truly appreciative. It's been a really fun conversation. Just a public shout out to Tim Gallagher again for connecting you and I, Jim. And
Tim's
everyone out there.
Lifelong friend. He really is a good guy. And you talk about a guy that's got basketball in his veins. That gentleman.
No question. He does. There's no question. So, Jim, thanks again for all your time tonight. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.